Good evening. My name is Ruben Galep and I am from Estonia. Tonight I am here with Mr. Greg Johnson, who is an American white nationalist, an intellectual, philosopher, and in my opinion, one of the wisest and most inspiring figures that we nationalists have on our side. Mr. Johnson has PhD in philosophy. He's the founder and editor of Countercurrents Publishing, which has a really great and intellectually rich website, counter-currents.com. He's author of 3 books. One of them is coming out this year. I really recommend his books and writings to anyone who is interested in our nationalist cause. So, I'm making this interview especially for Estonian readers and listeners, so we will talk generally about the situation of Europeans in Europe and worldwide, then a bit about liberal and post-communist Europe, and what is the role of Estonia and Estonian nationalists in all this mess. So, Greg, you have been a nationalist and white advocate in the USA for around 15 years. Can you freely express your opinions in the USA, or do you have to fear repercussions?
Well, Ruben, first of all, thank you for doing this interview and for your very kind introduction. There really aren't any laws against expressing nationalist ideas in the United States, because freedom of opinion is expressly protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. However, that does not protect nationalists from persecution and censorship by private organizations and individuals. The mainstream media, both leftist and right-wing, are entirely hostile to racial nationalist ideas, and they seldom bother with even a pretense of objectivity in their coverage. And left-wing agitators have led many universities and businesses and NGOs to adopt codes of conduct and mission statements that make adherence to multiculturalism and diversity conditions of employment. And this, of course, furnishes pretexts to fire anybody who's discovered to be a dissident. But even those pretexts really aren't necessary, as Americans can be fired at will by their employers for any reason. And if an employer thinks you've got controversial beliefs and that might cause him trouble with his business, he can simply dismiss you. Europe doesn't have the same constitutional protection of freedom of speech as in the United States, but in many European societies, it's not possible for employers to terminate people arbitrarily just based on their political beliefs. And I believe that in the end, constitutional guarantees of free speech mean very little if dissidents can be subjected to private censorship and persecution with impunity. And this may be why in Europe nationalists who have less legal freedom of speech actually speak more, and they speak more effectively in favor of nationalist policies.
Yes, I agree. Well, as you of course know, lately Europe has been struck by a migration crisis of unprecedented scale. So, what kind of results of it do you foresee for both the Europe and the whole world?
Well, all European nations have shrinking native populations. And if non-white immigration continues unabated, there really are only 3 possible outcomes as far as I can see. First, Europe will simply cease to exist, culturally and racially, once its populations are replaced by non-whites who breed faster. And once Europeans no longer exist, I fully expect that the other races are just going to breed recklessly and despoil the planet. And there's going to be nothing left, basically, but a blackened cinder in space. And thus I believe that the welfare of Europe is ultimately identical with the welfare of the world. So if you want to save the world, then you got to save the white race. We're the part that cares the most about the whole. But the second option is a better option, which is there will be civil wars in which the European populations either unite and expel the invaders and secure their borders, or they're going to fail, and we're back to option one, which is the end of Europe. The third option is the best, in my opinion, which is that nationalist parties will come to power, they'll secure their borders, and they're going to repatriate non-whites in an orderly and humane way. I hope that that third path is what Europe takes, but if the existing political establishments don't cede power to nationalist parties, then revolution and civil war will be the only other route to Europe's salvation. And under no circumstances, however, do I think that Europe is going to go gentle into the night of extinction. Of course, immigration into Europe by non-whites is nothing new. Nationalists have been warning Europeans about demographic displacement for decades now. But this sudden, massive influx of migrants from Africa and the Near East is actually a good thing, because the scope and the speed are so startling that people are awakening to this, and they've been sleeping through their slow displacement demographically for a very long time. And I think this is galvanizing new levels of European resistance. So in the end, I think this crisis is actually good. It's like a fever. Sometimes, you know, a body needs to have a fever in order to expel or to kill off some kind of infection. The temperature is going way up, and I think that that's perhaps a sign of health.
Are these demographic trends also similar in America?
The main trends are quite similar. White Americans, like white Europeans, are a shrinking population. And we're being replaced. We're being replaced by fast-breeding non-whites, both people born here and new immigrants coming in. The only real difference is that in the United States, the process is far more advanced than in Europe. The white population in the United States has declined from 90% in 1965 to about 65% today. And within a few decades, we will be under 50% of the U.S. population. Paradoxically, though, even though in Europe the demographic problem is far less pronounced than in the United States, the level of nationalist sentiment and organization is far higher. Europeans are far more alarmed by smaller numbers of aliens in their country than Americans have been. And I take this as a sign of greater racial and cultural health in Europe than in America.
So let's talk about Europe. You have been staying in Budapest, Hungary, for a while. Based on your experience, how would you compare the liberal Western Europe with the post-communist Eastern Europe?
Well, unlike some Western nationalists, I don't hate liberalism enough to praise communism. Except in a backhanded way. Despite its efforts, communism was not capable of destroying the ethnic consciousness and the European high culture of Eastern Europeans quite as effectively as Western liberalism and popular culture have done in the West. Therefore, I think there's a healthier national consciousness and a more vivid sense of a common European history and identity and high cultural heritage in the former communist bloc nations than in the West. And that's especially true in Hungary, which is the country I've spent the most time in. The amount of European high culture that you see in Hungary is remarkable. Now, Western Europe, I think, is a lot more culturally deracinated and debased than Eastern Europe, and that's largely because of the post-war hegemony of the United States. But again, I think Western Europe is a lot healthier than the United States, and the United States really is the vanguard of world nihilism today. And coming back from Eastern Europe, I've come to the conclusion that Eastern Europe needs to get over its inferiority complex to the West and to America. Eastern Europe should not be following the vanguard of nihilism. It should become the vanguard of European rebirth.
So, how would you comment on the current Hungarian immigration policies that are really strong and protecting their borders?
Well, Viktor Orban's policies and statements on the migrant crisis have been really the best of all European leaders. And he's encouraged resistance around Europe to these arrogant demands from Merkel and Brussels to impose quote-unquote refugee quotas. And Hungary has its political factions like all nations, of course, but my impression is that the Hungarian people are overall highly patriotic and they feel great solidarity with one another in resisting this invasion. And I think that's a sign of health, and I hope that other European nations will follow in their example. And there's already sign that that's happening with the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Poland. So we'll see.
Sure, that would be great. What kind of comparison would you make between the nationalist movements in Eastern and Western Europe?
Well, talking to Eastern Europeans, it became fairly clear to me that genetically speaking, they're more threatened by immigration of young people than by immigration of non-whites. But of course, Mrs. Merkel is trying to change that all very quickly. The biggest difference is that delusional views about Russia increase among nationalists the further west one goes. Other than that, I don't really see much difference between Eastern and Western European nationalists. I think very highly of nationalists in both Eastern and Western Europe. I look up to them. I expect more from the East, though, because they've got healthier societies to work with. For countries like England and France, Sweden and Germany, Italy and Spain, the path to national renewal is going to be a lot more difficult.
Which strategies work best for the nationalists?
Well, in politics and in warfare, it's a basic rule that you've got to attack the enemy where he's the weakest and you're the strongest. And right now, our enemies have never been stronger in terms of wealth and sheer brute force, right? Whereas nationalists, by contrast, have very little money and very little power at our disposal. However, the establishment has never been weaker in terms of its intellectual and moral underpinnings. And the intellectual and moral case for nationalism has never been stronger. On top of that, the people who run our countries are utterly cynical and corrupt. And some of them are just downright insane, and they're quite easily parodied. Whereas the nationalist movement today is drawing the most intelligent, righteous, upstanding, idealistic people in all European societies. Therefore, I think the battle at present has to be metapolitical, meaning that we need to destroy the dominance of anti-nationalist ideas. And we need to organize a vital nationalist movement. And that's got to consist not just of political parties, but a whole subculture. There have to be families and schools and businesses and think tanks, cultural events, publishers, artists and craftsmen, and so forth. And since nationalism is based on objective facts and moral principles that our enemies deny and flout, they can only grow weaker over time, and we can only grow stronger. And I think there will be a point when we can take political power from them, and then we'll protect our borders, we'll repatriate the outsiders, and we're going to be able to reverse our demographic and our cultural decline.
That's a great point. Now, would you make a prediction? How soon would this process start? And where will it begin in Europe?
Well, it's dangerous to make precise predictions, particularly because one thing that history does teach us is to expect the unexpected, meaning the unpredictable, right? And we don't want to be like those millennialist sects that kept predicting and then postponing the apocalypse. Failed prophecies and predictions can be really demoralizing after a while. So I think that the best way to sustain our efforts is not to offer overly precise predictions and rosy forecasts, or to foster the illusion that we can completely control events, that we've got a plan that we're just going to set in motion. Step one, step two, step three, and then victory. Instead, I think we have to follow the old Aryan ethic of duty. And basically that is the attitude you see in the Bhagavad Gita or Immanuel Kant. We have to do the right thing. and we have to detach ourselves from the consequences, which we can't really control. So we've got to keep fighting. We should never get discouraged. We should never soil ourselves with compromise. And we have to always remain worthy, morally worthy of victory. We can control that. We can control our own actions and our own worth more than we can control external events. And then we just have to let the gods sort out the contingencies. It's hubris to think that we can completely predict and control events. Now, an allied attitude that I think also detaches itself from this hubris is to regard the struggle not just as a moral duty, but as a game, right? As a source of joy and pleasure, which is something that you can sustain really as an end in itself, regardless of the consequences. And I think laughter really is a key thing. Laughter is glorying in our own superiority. We do not really believe that we can win. We do not really believe we deserve to win if we can't laugh at our enemies. Because if we laugh at our enemies, that means we really do look down on them. And we really think that they deserve mockery and contempt. And they richly deserve it. Now, this playful kind of spirit is really attractive to young and creative types. And I think it's the source of this endless wealth now of memes and parody songs and videos and podcasts and troll campaigns, right, that are now reshaping the actual parameters of political debate in the United States and certainly in Europe too. And this is what cultural struggle is. This is what metapolitics is in action. However, I do think that we can make some very broad predictions about the future. I am very optimistic that nationalism is going to break out somewhere in Europe and spread. Why? Well, because nationalism is the political philosophy that's best aligned with our nature as a people, and with the facts of reality, including the most pressing political problems faced by white people everywhere today. Problems like demographic decline and mass immigration, crime, ethnic conflict, and so forth. Multiculturalism is bringing conflict and chaos and poverty and misery wherever it's tried. And really the only solution is the ethnically homogeneous sovereign state, and that's what we stand for. And basically at this point, I'm just going to declare that we've won all the intellectual battles. Our leaders, the leaders of our society today, the establishment, is totally intellectually and morally bankrupt. But the trouble is, our people don't know that yet, right? And once we awaken enough of our people, and once the power of the increasingly brittle, hollow existing establishment to intimidate us into silence and conformism wavers just a bit, I think rapid political change is possible. And we saw that with the collapse of communism, which was just another version of the same lies that rule us today.
Yes. What advice would you give to a small country like Estonia that lies between the spheres of influence of Moscow at one hand, and Brussels and Washington at the other hand?
Well, I think the main reason why Eastern European countries are receptive to the EU and NATO in particular is their desire to secure themselves against Putin's Russia. Now, this is bad because NATO and the EU are vectors of Western decadence. And Central and Eastern Europeans may be militarily and economically weaker than the West, but they're racially and culturally a lot healthier, and those latter factors are really more important. Thus, I think that the Eastern Europeans really need to take control of their own security. And already, Poland and Slovakia, the Czech Republic and Hungary are part of the Visegrad Group, which is an economic and defense union that encompasses really the four most dynamic economies in Central and Eastern Europe and more than 60 million people. And that's a formidable bloc which I would like to see expand. And I think organically, maybe the Baltic countries should be the next ones to join it because they're well matched in terms of economic and educational factors. And eventually, I think such a bloc should encompass Ukraine, Romania, Moldova, and Bulgaria, and Belarus, too, if it leaves a Russian orbit. And Greece and the former Yugoslav republics are also candidates. Austria, too, really. And fully extended, I think such a bloc would have close to 200 million Europeans, which would be more than a match for Russia's 145 million, many of whom are non-Europeans. Now, this geopolitical bloc was the idea of the Polish interwar leader, Marshal Pilsudski, and he called it Intermarium, and there was a very widely read article about this just recently at Countercurrents. Now, for Pilsudski, of course, Intermarium was an imperial dream. He wanted to resurrect the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and no sovereign state today is going to sign up for the revival of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth or the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But a federation of sovereign states spanning from the Baltic to the Black Sea would obviate the need for Central and Eastern European nations to join NATO and the EU, and I think that would be a good thing. I think an intermarium bloc would allow the racially and culturally healthiest part of Europe to stop following the West into decadence and instead start leading it toward renewal. The East needs to get over its inferiority complex. It needs to rejoice in its health and its strength. And Matt Parrott once said something to me very wise that I think is applicable here. Sometimes you just have to set aside your humility and lead.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It has been very inspiring. You have given hope to nationalists in Estonia and the whole Europe. So, as Greg said, be brave, do your duty, and laugh at your enemies. They're just there so you can laugh at them. So, have a good night, Europe.
Thank you so much. I really have enjoyed this.